Well, good morning. G.K. Chesterton was one of the greatest theologians of the early 1900s. He was nicknamed the Prince of Paradox because he liked to use allegories and short stories and proverbs and popular sayings as ways to make his theological points. It's no surprise to us that he was a big fan of fairy tales. In fact, on one occasion he wrote this. He said, "Fairy tales are more than true, not because they tell us that dragons exist, but because they tell us that dragons can be beat." His favorite fairy tale of all time was Beauty and the Beast. You know, that book was written back in the 1700s. Probably, has anybody ever read the book? Let's be honest. How many of you have seen the cartoon? How many have seen the movie? You've seen those, hadn't you? Our knowledge of Beauty and the Beast comes from the Disney movies. Let's be honest. It's about a handsome prince who one evening, an older beggar woman comes to his castle looking for shelter. He turns her away, not knowing that she's an enchantress. She places a spell upon him in his castle, a spell that could only be broken by him finding true love in his hideous form by the age of 21. Well, for the next hour and a half, there's a lot of singing and dancing, and then we come to the end. And while he's laying mortally wounded, Belle confesses her love for him, kisses him, the spell is broken. And he's returned to his once priestly looking sight, but he's very different inside. Here's what Chesterton said about that. He said, "The unlovely must be deeply loved before they become lovable. Someone treated like an animal will become an animal. Someone treated with worth, dignity, and beauty as a human being will become a human being." And he took that fairy tale and he likened that to the ministry of Jesus Christ of all things. He said that really sums up what Christ did in those 3 years during his ministry. And you know what? When you start to think about the ministry of Christ, there's many things you can think about, isn't there? Maybe you think about all the many different places he went to. You know, Jerusalem, Galilee, Samaria, Transjordan area. Or maybe you think about the many sermons that he preached on the mount, on the plain, in the synagogues, on the street, out in the countryside. Or maybe you think about the many miracles that he performed. Turning water into wine, raising the dead, healing the sick. All the things that he did during that time of his ministry. But what I want you to think about is the people that he met and how they were so different and how they were so in need of many things. You think about a woman in Luke chapter 8, a woman who had an hemorrhage of blood for 12 years that had driven her into bankruptcy. Or how about a man described in Luke chapter 5 as full of leprosy. Or then we've got another woman in Mark chapter 7, a Syrophoenician woman, a Gentile who asked for crumbs of mercy from his table. They came to Jesus, didn't they? The leper, the lame, the lonely, the physically and soul sick. They came to Jesus asking for the world, asking to be healed, asking to be forgiven. And every one of those humble people who came to him, he would touch, he would heal, he would forgive. He'd preach the good news to him because he saw a soul worth saving. Really appreciate the invitation to come and be with you during this one day. By 4 o'clock, you're going to be so sick of hearing me that you can't wait to get back home. Wilson, I've known Wilson 44 years this past September. We first met on the campus of Florida College. Dear friend, even though I overlook who he married, I would say I think about you a lot, Wilson. I try not to think of Julie at all. But no, they are dear friends to us. And you can see that the way we talk to one another. Got my wife with me, Martha, and my youngest daughter, Molly, who is with me this evening, or this morning, that is. And we are so glad to be with you here. I want to look this morning during our class period at an outcast. And you know the story. And the things I'm going to tell you today is not something that's going to be new to you. It's going to be something that maybe you want to revisit. A story that comes from, I'm going to read from Luke chapter 8. If you want to go ahead and turn to Luke chapter 8 there. It may be the most tormented man that Jesus ever came across. It's found also in the book of Matthew and Mark, but I want to read from Luke's account there. As we start in Luke chapter 8, let's start reading about verse 26 there. Luke chapter 8, verse 26. It says, "Then they sailed to the country of the Gadarenes, which is opposite Galilee. And when he had stepped out on the land, there met him a certain man from the city who had demons for a long time. And he wore no clothes, nor did he live in a house, but in the tombs. When he saw Jesus, he cried out, fell down before him, and with a loud voice said, 'What have I to do with you, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, do not torment me.' For he commanded the unclean spirit to come out of him. For it had often seized him, and he had kept him under guard, bound with chains and shackles. And he broke the bonds and was driven by the demon into the wilderness. And Jesus asked him, saying, 'What is your name?' And he said, 'Legion,' because many demons have entered him. And they begged him that he would not command them to go into the abyss. Now a herd of many swine was feeding there on the mountain. So they begged him that he would permit them to enter them, and he permitted them. And then the demons went out of the man and entered the swine, and the herd ran violently down the steep place to the lake and drowned it. When those who fed them saw what had happened, they fled and told it in the city and in the country. Then they went out to see what had happened, and came to Jesus and found the man from whom the demons had departed sitting at the feet of Jesus, clothed in his right mind, and they were afraid. They also who had seen it told them by what means he who had been demon-possessed was healed. And then the whole multitude of the surrounding region, the Gadarenes, asked him to depart from them, for they were seized with great fear. He got in a boat and returned. And now the man from whom the demons had departed begged him that he might be with him. But Jesus sent him away, saying, 'Return to your own house and tell what great things God has done for you.' And he went his way and proclaimed throughout the whole city what great things Jesus had done for him." Luke says he comes to the land of the Gadarenes. Mark's account says he comes to the land of the Gergesenes. In Matthew's account, he comes to the country of the Gergesenes. There's different ways to pronounce this and different ways to say this, but it's all the same place. It's on the southeast side of the Sea of Galilee there. And upon arriving at that place, Jesus is met by a demon-possessed man, according to Luke and according to Mark. Now, if you go to Matthew's account, he's met by two demon-possessed men. But Luke and Mark only deal with the one, and so that's who we're going to deal with. The one man here that we find here in our text here. A demon-possessed individual. This may be a good time to say something about demon possession. You know, there's a lot of controversy and a lot of speculation about what demon possession is, even by religious scholars. What do we do with this demon possession that we find in the New Testament? Well, here's how some people have tried to explain what demon possession is. First off, to them, demon possession, it really is nothing more than an illness or a sickness. They believe it's ancient man's way to describe something that they really don't know anything about. Maybe it's a mental disorder, maybe it's some type of neurological disease, disease or something that has affected somebody. And so they really don't know what to describe or how to describe it, and certainly don't know how to treat it. And so they say, well, that's just demon possession. You know, this something that this physical disorder. But you know what? When you start to look at Scripture, that doesn't really fit. Let me show you Matthew chapter 4. Matthew chapter 4, Christ has come from the wilderness there. Matthew chapter 4. It says there, starting about verse 23 there, Matthew chapter 4. Excuse me. And Jesus went about all Galilee, teaching in their synagogues, preaching the gospel of the kingdom, healing all kinds of sickness and all kinds of disease among the peoples. And then his fame went throughout all Syria, and they brought to him all sick people who were afflicted with various diseases and torments. All right? Now look at let's continue now. Verse 24. And those who were demon-possessed, epileptics, paralytics, and he healed them. Now you see how they're distinguished from one another? You've got those who are sick, those who are paralytic, those who are epileptic, and demon-possessed. And my point is this, that demon possession is different than all that. It's not a physical disease that the ancient man had no idea how to deal with it or what to even call it. Now, demon possession could cause, of course, disease symptoms, couldn't it? Matthew chapter 9, we've got a demon-possessed man there who was mute. Well, Matthew chapter 12, we've got another demon-possessed man who was blind and mute. But not all physical ailments were the result of demons in some way invading somebody's body. You think about blind Bartimaeus over there in Mark chapter 10. There's no mention about him being demon-possessed. He was blind. Or how about John chapter 5, when Christ gets down to Bethesda there, and you see all the people that are laying about there that are sick, and now there's no mention whatsoever of them being demon-possessed. They were sick. They had some type of physical disease. And so what I guess I'm saying is this, that at times, yes, demon possession can affect people in the way that it brings about physical ailments. But not every case of physical disease should be attributed to demon possession. Another answer that some people give sometimes for what demon possession is that they say, well, that's Satan invading somebody's person and controlling that person. Luke chapter 22, verse 3, the text says that Satan enters Judas. And so they say, well, that's what happens when somebody's demon-possessed. Satan has entered that person and is affecting that person in some way. We need to be reminded, though, that it is true that Satan can take hold of us, but that's when we open the door and let him in. That's what Judas did. Judas opened the door to his heart and said, come on in. And he came on in, didn't he? He betrayed the Lord, didn't he? But what I find in the New Testament, that when somebody is demon-possessed, it's, in essence, the demon has kicked the door in and taken over that person's body, over that person's mind. It's not where Satan necessarily enters a person, but when some type of entity takes over that person's very mind and body, involuntarily does that to the person. And so I'm not the one who would say it's, you know, that. And others have said, well, really what demon possession is just symbolic. Again, it's the presence of evil in the world. It's not a literal indwelling of any type of spiritual being whatsoever. It's just symbolic of evil. And the casting out of demons was representative of the individual overcoming evil in his life, you see. But again, this belief ignores what the New Testament tells us about those people who were demon-possessed. When we start reading through the New Testament and we come across people who are demon-possessed, we're not talking about something that's symbolic. We're talking about something that's real. An invasion has taken place. Demon possession, there's another personality living inside that person that's operating inside that person. And I think this is best illustrated even from the text here we've got in Luke chapter 8 and over in really in other places. In Luke chapter 8 there, what we've got here, we've got somebody who's possessed by some type of spiritual entity that gives him, you might say, superhuman strength. Over in Matthew chapter 17, we've got a demon who causes a young man to throw himself in the fire or the water. Just like two wheels living inside the person. And we even see that here in our text. There's something else inside that man. If you read Luke chapter 8, and then you go over to Mark's account, Mark chapter 5, you're going to find out there are two people. Now look at Luke chapter 8, look at verse 28. It says, when he saw Jesus, he cried out, fell down before him, and with a loud voice said, what have I to do with you, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, do not torment me. Now, who's speaking there? I think the demon's speaking there. I think that's who's speaking. But look in Mark chapter 5. Mark adds a little bit to the story here. Mark says in Mark chapter 5, verse 6, it says, when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and he worshiped him. Folks, demons don't worship Jesus. I think that's the man, that other entity, the human, that's worshiping. It's the demon doing the speaking. And so I think there's two wills. There's a split personality, if you want to call it that, inside someone. And so here's the point. I don't think it's a sickness. I don't think it's necessarily Satan indwelling in somebody. It's not symbolic. And I'll tell you another thing. I think it ended, too. I think we read in in 1 Corinthians chapter 13 and Zechariah chapter 13 that it ended. It was all about Jesus showing his power and ability to do this. The perfect came there in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. There was no more need to confirm the word by exercising demons, by doing miracles. And so that's all past. But what I want to do for the rest of our time here is go back and look at Luke chapter 8. Because I think in Luke chapter 8, in the story of this man, we've got a great illustration about people who act like demons and how the world tries to handle those folks. and how Christ handles people like that. Let's be honest. You ever met somebody who just seems like have a demon inside them? I mean, just ornery. I'm not talking about children, all right? They get over that eventually. But someone who just seems to be, he's just mean. And they're just bent on doing maybe destruction, hurting people. We see that, don't we? But what we see is really a couple different ways that's handled, isn't it? So I want to talk about how first the world handles people like that. And I want to talk about then how Christ handles that. And then I want to end with what Christ wants that person to do after it's been handled. First of all, let's talk about the outside. How do we handle somebody who is, you might say, demon-possessed in the manner in which they are evil and mean and filled with all types of wrath? Well, how does the world handle people like that? Well, how did they handle him back here? Back in Luke chapter 8, what did they do? Here's a man, and let's be honest, he's the boogeyman, isn't he? He's terrorizing that community. They're scared to death of him. So what do? They put chains on him. They put chains on him, and they try to chain him up, but he breaks the chains. And he keeps breaking the chains. No chain can hold this man. All they can do is try to, in some way, control him, restrain him on the outside. And that's the exact way we try to do today with people that are just flat out evil. December 14th of 2012, 20-year-old Adam Lansing entered Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. He had one thing on his mind that morning, to kill as many people as he could. And when he was done, he had killed 20 children ages 6 to 7 and 6 adults. When first responders first got to the scene, the young man shot himself. Sandy Hook Elementary would be the deadliest mass shooting in a school to America to date. The nation was shocked, needless to say. But what was the solution that many politicians in Hollywood and the media and the wizards of the smart told us we need to do? More gun control. Oh, we only had more gun control, but that would have never happened. That's just an illustration of trying to restrain the outside, isn't it? In essence, they're saying we didn't have enough chains. If we just had enough chains on that guy, you see, that would never happen. Is that true? Would more gun control stop that? Would more gun control have kept that young man from entering that school and stopped him from shooting those children? By restraining the outside, that's all people can come up sometimes with. Last September, we walked over a bridge in London, England, where not too many months before that, somebody in a car was running people over. Well, should we restrain the use of cars? This past spring, I think it's in China or Japan, one of those places, somebody got in a school and stabbed 16 children with a knife. All right, should we get rid of knives? How about baseball bats? How about hammers? You know, they can do some damage too, can't you? How about curtains? You know that more people hang themselves on their curtains accidentally than a lot of other deaths in this nation? You see what I'm getting at? All we can ever come up with is, let's restrain the outside. And the one thing we need most is what people tell us we need least of. And that's Christianity. You might have heard of this man before. His name is Edward Burke. Politician, statesman actually from Scotland. He said years ago that society cannot exist unless a controlling power upon will and appetite be placed somewhere. And the less of it there is within, the more there must be without. Now think about that just for a moment. What has kept so many people from doing violent acts? What has been that restraining force for so long in our nation and other places? I'll tell you what it's been. It's been Christianity. It's been Jesus Christ. It's the instilling within people the fact that Christ has told us what we should do, what we should not do. That has been the greatest controlling power upon people for generations upon century upon century. But yet people come along and say, what we need less of is that. And the more and more we get away from Christ, the more Sandy Hooks we have. And they're just going to continue, and they're going to get worse and worse. All we're doing is just falling into the same pattern that people did back then. Restrain the outside. That's all we can come up with. Shackle people. But yet the chains and the shackles are often broken, aren't they? Well, Christ comes on the scene. And Christ isn't going to deal with the outside. He's going to deal with the inside. You know, he doesn't get there. He said, you know what? The problem with you folks here in this area is that you don't have strong enough chains. You know, if you can just find some strong enough chains and enough of them, you'll keep this guy under control. He doesn't say that, does he? What does Jesus do? What does Jesus do? Well, Jesus deals with the inside of the man, doesn't he? And he's told us that's where all the bad things in life takes place originally, is inside a person, isn't it? Matthew chapter 15, verse 19, Christ says, "For out of the heart proceeds evil thoughts, murders, adultery," and go down through the entire list there. It starts in the heart. And so what Jesus wants to do is change people's hearts. And doing that, they change the attitudes, the wills and wants of so many folks. As true as it was in the days of Christ, oh, don't we need it today? We need some changed hearts, don't we? You know, for many centuries, killing children have been recognized as the worst depravity imaginable to man. Earlier this year, the governor of Virginia advocated in solidarity with Pharaoh and Herod that killing children is an acceptable way of disposing of unwanted babies. The state of New York passed an amendment into their constitution that allows the killing of children up until the time of birth. And that was celebrated by a standing ovation in the New York Senate. Buildings in New York were turned pink to celebrate that. I don't know if you can get any lower than that, can you? And what we find is that politicians come along and they try to outdo one another about when we ought to kill children. To the point now that some advocate, well, let the child be born. And if the mother or the father doesn't want the child, then kill it then. Folks, when you kill children and you think that's okay, where do you stop? If it's okay to kill a child, well, why not kill somebody who's elderly? You know, he doesn't have the quality of life any longer. You know, he can't be productive for society. Well, let's just put him to death. Some people have advocated that, haven't they? If it's all right to kill the elderly, then what about people who maybe have different political views than we have? You know? That's a good thought, isn't it? Let's do away with them. Or maybe people that don't quite look like us. Well, you know, that's a pretty good thought too, isn't it? Let's do away with them. Where do you stop? You want to kill children? Babies? Where do you stop? How do we change it, folks? I want to tell you, it's not by electing the right politician. Because the right politician, in my mind, has been elected many, many times over. And has it changed it? No. It changes when Christ is taught and His word is obeyed and kept and spread. And when hearts and minds are changed, that's when it stops. But until that time, it's going to continue and it's going to get worse and worse and worse. Jesus comes on the scene. He exorcises the demon, doesn't he? He knows what this man needs most. He knows that the demon needs to get out of this man. And so he exorcises the demon. He gets rid of the demon, doesn't he? Now, what's the reaction of the folks there of that region? Did you notice that? Look again down there. What's the reaction? Verse 35. Instead of praising Christ, it says they were what? They were afraid of Christ. Now, why were they afraid of Him and even the man now? Well, the answer, I think, is found in Luke chapter 8, verse 36 there. Look what it says there. This is the report that's being spread here. They also who had seen it told them by what means he who had been demon-possessed was healed. Now, again, here's where Matthew's going to add a little bit to the story. Look at Matthew chapter 8 real quick. Look at verse 33. Matthew chapter 8, verse 33. I think there's something in order there that maybe gives it a little indication of perhaps why they were afraid and why they were seemingly upset. Matthew chapter 8, verse 33, it says, "Then those who kept them fled, and they went away into the city and told everything, including what had happened to the demon-possessed man." Now, the way that I read that is this. They go back in the city and they say, "Hey, we just lost a herd of swine. Oh, and by the way, you remember that demon-possessed man that lived in the tombs that everybody was scared of? He's okay now. He's fine." That's kind of how I read that. And if that's so, then what was more important to them? Well, it's the swine, wasn't it? It's those pigs. That was more important to them. You know, there have been Bible scholars who have written on this text right here, and they have just given Jesus down the road. You know the reason why? Because Jesus has destroyed property. That's why. They just can't believe that Christ would, cause these pigs to be destroyed on this occasion. Now the question would be, why does Jesus allow that? Why did he tell the rich young ruler to go sell everything he had? You know, he never told anybody else that, did he? But Luke chapter 18, he told the rich young ruler, "Hey, sell everything you want. You want to follow me? Sell everything you have." So why does he tell that man? Well, I'll tell you why he told that man. Because Christ knew what was keeping that man from him. That's why. He knew what was inside that man. He knew that man was a lover of money. And so he needed to get that first. He needed to exercise that from within, you see, to follow Christ. Now you look back at the text here. I think Jesus knew what was in the hearts of those Gadarenes. I think he knew what was more important to them. It wasn't so much this guy was terrorizing us. What was more important to them was the herd of swine, wasn't it? And that's why I think in Matthew's account, they go back and they tell the story. Hey, the herd of swine, they've all been destroyed here. And by the way, the man that used to terrorize us, he's all right. So I think why Jesus allowed the destruction of the pigs is to show really where the hearts of the people were at this time. And getting our heart right is the most important thing. If that means some hogs must die, then so let them die. Now you look at the text here, and there's something in here where it says that the demons said that we are legion. There's many of us here. And it says that Christ commanded them to leave, but they didn't leave seemingly right out of the way, did they? They begged Christ, "Don't send us into the abyss, send us over to the pigs, send us to the swine." And Christ says, "Okay, I'll do that." Now I wonder, now I hope I'm not out of the box right now, I wonder if those demons were smiling when he said that. Maybe chuckling a little bit. "He's not going to send us into the abyss. He's going to send us into the hogs." But folks, when your last audible noise is an oink, the joke's on you. If you ever wonder where deviled ham comes from, right there it is. That's how Christ makes devil to him. Well, that's how Jesus dealt with this man, the inside. They dealt with the outside. Now let's talk about the upside. The people have asked Christ to leave, hadn't they? We shouldn't read really anything unduly malicious in the request for Jesus to leave. The fear is a natural reaction when we recognize that, in the presence of supernatural. We might liken it today. We understand the necessity of having nuclear power. We know the benefits of that, But do you want a nuclear reactor built in your backyard? Probably not. You've got Christ in your midst. You've got someone who's done something that no one else could do. They're afraid, aren't they? You know, I think about, you know, Peter over in Luke chapter 5. There, Peter, when he was faced with the power of Jesus Christ, what does Peter say? You know, he asked him to leave, didn't he? You know, please leave, you know. And I think that's what the Gadarenes were asking Christ, to leave their country. We just don't want this type of supernatural power. We can't deal with this. And so they beg Jesus to leave here. And Jesus is going to honor their request. He's going to leave. But look at the man's reaction. Look again down here in down in chapter 8 here. Verse 38, now the man from whom the demons had departed begged him that he might be with him, but Jesus sent him away. The man wants to go with Jesus. Here's the man that was naked and living in the tombs and howling at night. Now he's clothed, he's in his right mind. He wants to go with the man who took care of him. But what does Christ say to the man? Verse 39. So now you can't go with me, but return to your house and tell what great things God has done for you. Jesus said, I'm going to leave you behind so you can tell your story to everybody in this area. Anybody that will listen, I want you to tell your story to them. Well, how does that turn out? Well, we can find out this, can't we? Go to Mark chapter 7. Mark chapter 7 is going to tell us how this turns out. Now, excuse me. Remember, Christ is going to leave the man behind. He tells the man to go back to your home. Tell the people what I've done for you, all right? Go to Mark chapter 7. Look at verse 31 there. Mark chapter 7. It says, again, departing from the region of Tyre and Sidon, he came through the midst of the region of Decapolis to the Sea of Galilee. Now, I want you to understand that Decapolis there is our region here, the Gadarenes. That's what the Romans called it, the Decapolis, the 10 cities. So Christ has come back to the area, all right? Verse 32, they brought to him one who was deaf and had an impediment in his speech, and they begged him to put his hand on him. All right, so Christ is going to heal the man, all right? So here are these people, they're bringing to Jesus a man that needs to be healed, someone who's at some proper physical ailment here. And look at verse 36, and then he commanded them that they should tell no one, but the more he commanded them, the more widely they proclaimed it, and they were astonished beyond measure, saying, he has done all things well. Now, folks, that's the same folks. That's the same people that just a little while ago said, please leave our area. We don't want you here. And now, they can't get enough of him. I would say that probably that former demon-possessed man had done a pretty good job of getting the message out about Jesus. And I think Christ is counting on us to do the same thing. I know we all get nervous about the word testimonial because of what some folks have taken and done with that. But is it wrong to tell somebody what Jesus has done for you in your life? Is it wrong to go to somebody and say, listen, I want you to know about Christ because here's what he did for me? You know, if it's wrong for us to do that, then it was wrong for Paul to do that because Paul did it on at least two occasions that I know of in the book of Acts, didn't he? He testified about what Christ had done for him. And in telling what Christ had done for him, he was trying to bring others to Jesus that they might have something done in their lives that would benefit them. Jesus changed this man's life totally, didn't he? He changed him totally. And then that man, I truly believe, tried to help others change their life by coming to Jesus. What did Christ instruct his disciples to do there in Acts chapter 1? You be a witness to me. Tell others about me. Share the good news. Show others what's happened in your life, that they may want to come and have that done in theirs. Well, I'm early, you know. You told me to go to 9:45? I had to put two sermons together just to do that. Wilson, I want you to know that. So, all right, just stop right here. All right, we'll stop right here. All right. Thank you so much for your attention.